The Jericho Network on Westwood One. Hey, thanks for spending time with me here on Talk is Jericho. Today kicks off part one of a killer conversation with the Hardy Boys. I've got both of them, Matt and Jeff. They grew up on a tobacco farm, thought they were going to be pro baseball players, went to WrestleMania 4 as kids, gave up the baseball dream and built a trampoline wrestling ring in their backyard and never, ever looked back. Matt and Jeff Hardy coming up. But first, we got to take care of a little football biz. Not happy with the way your season-long fantasy team is doing. Playing bad. Got some bad players. You got the lowest point total in your league. Don't worry. You're not out of the money yet. Go to DraftKings.com and win some instant cash this week, right now. If you go to DraftKings.com now and enter the promo code Y2J, you'll get free entry into DraftKings Millionaire Maker event where first place takes home $1 million. That's right. Enter Y2J at DraftKings.com for a free shot at becoming the world's next millionaire. How would that be? That'd be pretty cool, huh? Don't let your season-long fantasy team get you down, man. Get some instant gratification and maybe even some instant cash every week at DraftKings.com. And remember, enter Y2J for a free entry into the Millionaire Maker event, DraftKings.com. Bigger events, bigger winnings, bigger millionaires. You got to check it out and do it right now.
The following program is a PodcastOne.com production.
He's a world champion wrestler, best-selling author, actor, and lead singer of Fozzy. Now he's rocking the podcast world.
Yay!
This is Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, starring Chris Jericho.
Welcome to Talk is Jericho, the pot of thunder and rock and roll. The spell you're under will be broken by Chris Jericho. Yeah, the People's Podcast has arrived. The remedy for boredom is here. Let's go for a ride.
Guess what? I got a fever. And the only prescription is more cowbell.
Yeah! Bow out and out and out and 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 bow out and out and bow out and out and bow out and out and stone free, but I'm bum 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 bum, get out and bum bum bum, stone free, but I'm bum 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 bum, but I'm bum 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 bum, stone free, but bum 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 bum. Woo! Man, that was a good time. I actually had to walk around the studio. If you heard it fade out, it's because I was doing a little march. I'm into it, man. Jerichoholics, how in the hell are you? It's Talk is Jericho. It's a great day. Very, very cool. Stone free Jimi Hendrix. Little Hendrix, man. Always makes you feel better. And you should feel good because today I got Matt and Jeff Hardy. The Hardy Boys are coming up. They grew up on a tobacco farm in North Carolina. Gilbert is their father. Great guy. They were very isolated. No neighbors. No other kids to play with growing up. We talk all about that and about how their upbringing led them to become one of the biggest tag teams in pro wrestling history. They started out with their own wrestling promotion, Omega, when they were like teenagers. They had some great gimmicks and costumes in those early days. We'll discuss that. They're also the guys who pioneered the modern day ladder match, table match, chairs match in the WWE. Lots of cool stories and stuff to talk about with the Hardy Boys on the way, but I need to start by saying thanks to you for tuning in, and thanks for doing your Amazon shopping through my links at podcastone.com. Easiest way to support the show. Amazon is a proud sponsor of Talk is Jericho, and every time you shop at Amazon through my link, Amazon gives a small percentage of your purchase back to the show to help us cover production costs. You don't have to buy anything special, won't cost you anything extra. Buy whatever you were planning to buy and help the show out in the process. Help me out. Help me to help you in the process. Go to podcastone.com. Click on the Keep Our Podcasts Free banner at the top of the page. Then hit the Talk is Jericho button. I've got Amazon links for the US, the UK, and Canada, all over that. Bookmark it so you can get those links in one easy click. Go check it out. Help me out. And I'm glad that you're helping me out. Very, very cool to be here. I'm in Atlanta. I mean, a studio, a rehearsal studio. We just finished the Fozzie rehearsals for the Do You Want to Start a War tour that begins with Theory of a Dead Man. Tomorrow, basically tonight, actually, Wednesday night, starts off in Phoenix, where we'll be at the Marquee in Tempe. Then on Tuesday, Abilene, Texas, The Lucky Mule. That's Fozzie on our own with Avatar. On the 19th, which is Friday, San Antonio at Backstage Live. Then the 20th in Shreveport at the KTUX Festapalooza, back to Louisiana where I just was last night. And then head over to Nashville for the big Night of Champions pay-per-view. My last match in the WWE for a while. But don't worry, don't you fret. I'm not retiring. I'm not leaving you. I'm going to be continuing forward better than ever. You know, I had a really fun time on this last run. I really enjoyed it. I think it's because I had a purpose. You know, I came back to work with Bray Wyatt specifically. That was kind of the deal that I made. This weekend I have Randy Orton, which will be a lot of fun as well. But I really kind of had something to sink my teeth into, and I really enjoyed the time that I had with the WWE. Last year I came back. It's when I did the feud with Fandango. And then I was just kind of working with everybody and had real no direction and nothing really going on. I worked with Ryback for a bit, and I worked with Ziggler for a bit, and I worked with Punk for a bit, but it was just kind of like losing, win one match, lose. I kind of became the veteran job guy. And, you know, winning and losing doesn't mean everything, but it means something. And you can't just lose all the time and expect to have any credibility and expect it to mean something when someone beats you. And this time it was the exact opposite of that. So really enjoyed the time in the WWE this last trip. Worked with Kane on Monday night. It was always fun to work with him. Big man. I don't know if you saw, I got cut open underneath my jaw. I got 5 stitches, and it happened basically. He just gave me an elbow in the corner, but the elbow didn't even touch me. His shoulder caught me. He's such a big shoulder. It's like this bowling ball shoulder hitting me underneath the chin and cutting me open to give me 5 stitches. And man, have things ever changed? There's a couple drops of blood on the mat, and suddenly referee Mike Chioda, he's got his rubber gloves on, and they're checking you. Are you okay? Are you okay? And the worst thing that can happen is, and this is something that they have to do by verdict of Vince McMahon, that if somebody's bleeding and it can't be stopped or it can't be curtailed, you got to stop the match so that the referee can get in there and stop the bleeding for you using Vaseline or whatever tricks that they have. But talk about killing the flow of your match. And this is a real thing. Like, you have to stop, and you're basically doing this wrestling match, this show, and then, you know, something real happens. You get cut open. It's like, okay, guys, the show is done because somebody really got hurt, so now we're going to stop everything and get you fixed up. And it makes everybody mad. I mean, nobody wants to stop in the middle of your match. Like I said, it kills if you're telling the story. You got a beginning, a middle, and the end. And if somebody gets cut open and suddenly you got to stop for 5 minutes, it's like Wayne's World when the car goes by and they got to stop to, you let the car go past and they continue their game. That's exactly what it is. It's like, all right, tackle, drop down, leapfrog, body slam, blood. Everyone just has to stop and wait for the ref to get the doctor in, and the doctor comes in and puts the Vaseline on and applies pressure and makes sure that it's not going to continue. And then, you know, okay, game on. And that happened to me once. I worked with Yoshitatsu a few years ago. I'd worked with him in Japan, and we had a really good match. And I said, listen, man, I mean, we tore the house down, actually. And I said, listen, you need to work that way that you just worked with me in Japan all the time. And lo and behold, we happened to go back and we were working a Superstars match, which is what was the other kind of like the main event show at that time. And I said, listen, man, I want to see you work that Japanese style. Don't give me this timid Yoshitatsu stuff. And starting the match, he was super timid and pissed me off. So I slammed him on the ground and I took my knee pad off and I dropped a knee right in the middle of his face and it cut him open. And the doctor came in and we had to stop the match. And then the doctor gave him stitches or whatever he did right at the scene of the crime. Well, I grabbed a folding chair and I put it down in the middle of the ring. And I just sat there with my arms crossed, like, all right, whatever. And I'll tell you what, when that match started again, Yoshitatsu was a different guy. He came in there and he kicked the shit out of me. And it was great. It was probably one of the better matches he had in the WWE. But I had to cut him open to do it. And you know, is that unprofessional? Kind of, but also I wanted to light a fire under his ass, and I did. The only thing was, you know, that we had to wait while the doctor repaired it. And I mean, years ago, you would, you know, you could be cut wide open, you could break your nose, whatever, and they would never stop the match for nothing. If you stopped the match halfway through, it was almost seen as a wimpy thing to do. So we grew up in the time where you do not stop a match no matter what. Those times have changed, and now if you, you know, have a nosebleed, they'll stop it and get the referee in there. So, but I love it. It's the sign of the times. Enjoyed Monday Night Raw with Kane. Enjoyed SmackDown. It was me and Roman Reigns against Seth Rollins and Orton. Got the big victory against Orton. Got the big victory against Kane, too, with roll-ups. I'm the king of the roll-ups. I'm the wacky roll-up guy. That's actually what I used to call John Cena, because when he first got his push, the only matches he ever won are ones that he won with roll-ups. So, but I'll tell you what, Seth Rollins, great worker. I really enjoy working with him. We have good chemistry. We worked in Boston last Sunday at a live event and tore the house down. Really, really cool chemistry being in the ring with him. Reminds me of a young me, all right? Reminds me of a young me. But one more match against Randy Orton, Night of Champions in Nashville. But like I said, we got Phoenix, we got Abilene, we got San Antonio, we got Shreveport, Louisiana. It's time for Fozzy to get back on the road. Time for us to continue to dominate and continue that momentum. Lights Go Out, the top rock song on the Panda strip club DJ charts for the third month in a row. Yeah, exactly. We are the highest charting rock song on the strip club DJ charts, which is so amazing. One of my favorite things, one of my favorite stats. You know, if the strippers like it, then I'm happy. And listen to these songs. Number 5, Habits, Chainsmokers remix with Tove Lo. Number 6, No Mediocre, Stevie B remix from T.I. featuring Iggy Azalea. Number 7, Wiggle with DJ Bravo Twerk Mix as Jason Derulo featuring Snoop Dogg. All About That Bass, Stevie B remix again. The Stevie B's all over the place. That's Meghan Trainor. Number 9, Anaconda, Nicki Minaj. Number 10, Am I Wrong, Nico and Vins. And number 11, Lights Go Out by Fozzy, the top charting rock song on the strip club DJ's chart. So thanks, strippers, for digging our song. And we're excited. We just rehearsed today a Bad Tattoo, which actually a couple of the songs, SOS, Died With You, Bad Tattoo, Do You Want to Start a War, Lights Go Out, all will be included in the set. One Crazed Anarchist. But the cool thing is that Bad Tattoo, if you've heard the song, and if you haven't heard it, shame on you, stick your hand out. Stick your hand out. I'm going to slap it. I just slapped it. Did you hear that? It's got a theremin in it. Now, what is a theremin, you might ask? If you've ever seen Led Zeppelin, Whole Lot of Love video, Jimmy Page plays that theremin. It's like, you control it with your hands, like, if you watched American Horror Story, the chick played a theremin, one of the witches. Anyways, a lot of people hear the solo in this next song, Bad Tattoo, and wonder, what's that sound in the middle? What kind of a guitar effect is it? Not a guitar effect, it's a theremin. And you're going to get to hear that live when you come see us on this tour. And you're going to get to hear it right now from Do You Want to Start a War? This is Bad Tattoo, featuring the genius of Rich Ward and his theremin. Crank it up!
Can be redeemed.
All right, what'd you think? A bad tattoo. Wicked, huh? Theremin. Haven't heard of Theremin in 20, 30 years. If you have, if you remember a band that's used the Theremin recently since Led Zeppelin, hit us up on the Twitter at Talk Is Jericho, at Fozzy Rock, and let us know who that band is, and come see us live, and you will love what you see. All right, Hardy Boys are next, but first, I gotta say, I did my DDP yoga after Raw last night. I just keep trashing myself. I mean, I hurt my toes in the cage match against Bray Wyatt last Monday. I hurt them again in Boston. I kind of cracked my back. I got cut open. I hurt my arm. But guess what? I got the remedy for something that will cure whatever ails you. DDP Yoga. Staying loose because I still got the Night of Champions pay-per-view coming up. And the Fozzy Tour with Theory of a Dead Man starts tonight. And I got to be ready to go because those shows are very physically taxing as well. A lot of cardio, a lot of jumping up and down, a lot of breath control. I need to stay in shape. And as much as DDP Yoga helps me, it can do the same thing for you. This is why I can jump off the top of a cage at 43 years old. Specifically and only because of DDP Yoga. A great fitness program for anyone at any age and any fitness level. You don't have to be a professional athlete. You just have to be you. And because you listen to Talk Is Jericho, DDP has given you a great deal on the Max Pack. I use it myself. 15 workouts designed for any skill level. Plus, you get a nutrition guide, a poster to help you remember the 12 core positions of DDP Yoga. And you get the workouts on MP3s so you can do them anywhere. I did it in the hotel room on the floor. Put a towel down. That's all I needed. You can exercise anywhere, anytime you want. You got to give this a try. I'm telling you, if you like Chris Jericho, listen to me and give DDP Yoga a try. It's ddpyoga.com/Jericho and take advantage of this special offer only available to you, the sexy beast listeners of Talk Is Jericho. ddpyoga.com/Jericho. But guess what? This offer is not going to last forever. You got to go to ddpyoga.com/Jericho. Take advantage of it now. Once again, that's ddpyoga.com/Jericho. And you can find this great deal by going to podcastone.com. Click on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, then hit the Talk Is Jericho button. Go try DDP Yoga now. You won't regret it. It's got the Y2J stamp of approval. I guarantee it.
Sal, have you had your daily dose of Adam Carolla yet?
Nope.
Well, maybe you want to listen to Loveline when you want, where you want. Or you want to hear Adam and Dr. Drew do a classic Loveline from the 90s.
Yes!
Then do yourself a favor and get to podcastone.com right now. That's podcastone.com.
Talk Is Jericho.
All right. We are here in Sanford, man, which is Sanford, North Carolina, which is close to the home of the Hardy Boys, Reynolds, North Carolina.
Correct.
In Chris Jericho's translation, Reynolds.
Reynolds. We've got Matt and Jeff, though, close to Cameron, which is cool that you guys still live there. You grew up there and have lived there your whole lives, never moved, right?
That's correct, yeah. We grew up on 120 acres of family land that was passed down from our dad's father to our dad and then now to us, obviously. And we have both 25 acres on both corners, so it's real cool. It's nice. It's private.
Oh, so it's like a family homestead sort of thing.
Yeah.
Oh, right. No reason to move anywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it worked out great. I mean, when we were in the hectic travel of being on the road 300 days plus with WWE when we were coming up doing our thing, you know, it was nice to come back just to nothingness, especially mm-hmm. when we were in that hecticness every single day, you know. And we come there. It's very peaceful. There's a lot of serenity there. And we both dig it. We're both country boys at heart. I mean, where we were born and raised, we're lucky we can read and write. You know, we were raised by wolves. You know, our mom died early. Our dad was a hard worker and brought us up. So, yeah, man, we love it. Cameron is very special to us.
It wasn't that bad. But where my house is and my motocross track, it used to be tobacco fields, which is kind of cool because I reminisce and think about all that hard-ass work we did back in the day. But now it's my home.
Mm. How was it growing up? Like you mentioned, your mom passed away early, and your dad's a great guy, Gilbert, the legendary Gilbert. Was it kind of like, did you guys have to, was it a lot of hard work? What kind of work did he do? Was he like a farmer or what was Gilbert's job?
He was a rural letter carrier and he was, not on full time in the beginning. He worked every 2 weeks on every Saturday. So to kind of compensate and to make a living for us, he raised tobacco and we did every job there is to do if you're a tobacco farmer. When we were both little, when we could first walk, we were putting sticks on the tobacco stringer and then we were putting tobacco on there. And then later we were driving the tractor. Then later we were priming tobacco. You know, so we did everything. We ran the whole gauntlet as far as all the jobs go there. But it was very hard work, but also it was rewarding. Like, we enjoyed it. It was fun for us to do that in many ways.
And by the time we evolved to, like, being a professional tobacco farmer, knowing it all, you know, he went full-time on the mail route, and therefore, you know, he didn't have to farm anymore.
Well, you guys grew up, like, very close family, and also, like, I always think, like, very, very artistic family. Were you guys always kind of wanting to get into the wrestling business? I mean, I know both you guys have done so many things, you know, sculptures and music and sewing even and stuff like that. It seems like you always were very creative kids.
I think part of the reason we were forced to be creative was just the environment we came up in, because, as I said, like, we grew up on 120 acres of land. We didn't have neighbors. You know, we didn't have any other kids our age that were around us. Whenever Jeff and I grew up, I mean, how we entertained one another was to go out in the woods. We had, like, a secret group. We were the adventurers when our cousins would come over, and we would build, like, hideouts and houses and camps, and, like, we would explore the lands and territories, and we were right beside a boys' camp where it was kind of like, you know, younger kids who didn't have parents or were troubled kids would come, and they have 1,000-plus acres. So we also had that land, and we'd explore into it. Sometimes we'd be gone all day just, like, walking across the land, and we would have to come up with things to entertain ourselves and be creative. So I really think that helped got our creative juices flowing in the beginning.
Yeah, and where did wrestling come into play? Were you guys always kind of captured the imagination by wrestling, or when did you guys start getting involved with being fans of that?
God, I'm not sure. I remember, like, going to Fayetteville, though, to our first live show and just being, I mean, completely obsessed with, like, what I just saw. Oh, my God, I want to do this, you know, and we were in love with it, but I think it was WrestleMania.
WrestleMania 4. It was the big one, the turning point.
The big turning point for us. Yeah, we saw that when Macho Man won the title,
yeah.
I believe.
We both played baseball coming up, and we both loved baseball. That was, I think, our initial dream. We both wanted to be professional baseball players. And then once we got to WrestleMania 4, we started watching around right before they did the thing where they had the double Hebners and they tried to screw Hogan out of the title.
Yeah, classic,
and we became a huge classic. And we became fans from there on. And at WrestleMania 4, we made bets on who were going to win, and we both liked Macho Man, and he liked the Warriors well, and Macho Man ended up winning. That was one of the guys we'd kind of noted that we dug. And from that point on, we watched every week, and we loved it. We were absolutely in love, obsessive with it after Macho Man won, and he was our guy. Mm-hmm. We both got mad at Hogan. You know, whenever Macho Man turned, we're like, damn you, we know you're going to win the title now. You know, but that was the point. We knew we wanted to be a living, breathing superhero that is a professional wrestler at that point.
And you mentioned your first show was at Fayetteville. Was that a WWE show?
I think NWA.
We went to NWA originally.
Because this neck of the woods is more of an NWA North Carolina, right?
This was a Mid-Atlantic NWA thing. And we probably 5 or 6 of those shows came here to every one WWE show, like Fayetteville. The first WWE show we went to in Fayetteville, though, was huge. And it was Andre the Giant versus Big John Studd in the main event. And I remember that was pretty breathtaking to see guys of that size doing the thing, you know. But and WWE was just such a spectacle, as it always has been, you know. Then it was just, you know, you saw NWA as like, man, these are the guys that are like my dad. They would, like,
that's right,
they would whip your ass, you know. They would beat you up. These guys are really fighting, you know. But WWE are big stars, like guys that would be in Hollywood if they weren't wrestling, you know.
Yeah.
Presentation was very different.
Always looked so much bigger too. I remember growing up in Canada when AWA was always there every month, and like you said, it was like beer drinking guys and big, you know, beer bellies, and the Crusher and Ray Stevens and Baron Von Raschke. And then the next month, suddenly it was WWE, and all the guys were just massive and jacked up, and there's snakes and birds and hot chicks. You'd never seen anything like that before, right?
It totally was. I mean, WWE was just such a presentation, such a spectacle, but NWA was just more of a vibe of like, oh my God, these guys, they would, I wouldn't want to run into them in the street because they would really whip your ass.
Yeah.
You know, I think the WWE guy, he would be nice and probably just sign my autograph and we'd take photos because he'd be cool. You know, but the other guys, there was just really an air of like, they were real in what they were doing.
Did you guys used to go try and find the wrestlers after the shows or try and find them at the gym or anything like that? Or did you even know that you could do that?
We would wait for sure at the buildings just to see them get in their car, you know, or whatever, and just get a little closer to them and see them in their, you know, street clothes or
we never tracked them down at the hotel, or you know, maybe we didn't go that far to think like, oh my God, where are they at, or you know, seek these guys out. But we would want to try and get there early and see them arrive and what they were doing. Oh my God, I remember when we first, you know, went in the late 80s, early 90s, when guys were starting to rock Zubaz, and that was the whole trend. We're like, oh my God, we got to have those. I mean, and you know, when we first started wrestling, you know, Zubaz, high techs, right, I'm sure you had a pair at some point, you know, tucked into the high techs, and the, you know, like the tank top. We even had the muscle shirt that with the
shoulders cut out. You know,
I had an whole outfit. It was brutal. Because
that was the wrestler uniform. Yeah. The Zubaz were kind of like the fancy sweats.
Yeah, yeah.
And with, like you said, with the high top sneakers tucked in, or cowboy boots and Zubaz were good ones.
Cowboy boots were very popular as well.
The gimmick bag, the fanny pack.
Oh, yeah.
And then the really, like, the barely, like, the string muscle shirt, right?
Yeah. We went to the first TVs with Stallion at Youngstown, Ohio.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
God, I'll never forget seeing Luger pull up in, like, this, you know, boat of a Lincoln. And then he gets out, and he had a completely, like, long-legged black and blue pinstripe unitard. And then when the muscle shirts, and it was the crib, and the little hip pack.
Yeah.
But I thought it was the coolest shit ever. I want to pull that off one day.
And I remember you had a few pairs of tights like that.
Me and Marty Garner, we found a pair of tights, man, like black and white stripes. And I wore those out a few times.
it was funny. The more I look at it, you know, like when we put on the Zubaz or tights like he did, you know, we had the fanny pack and the silly ass shirt. I mean, it was almost like when we were dressed up walking around like this, we're like, oh my God, we're going to be in wrestling. And we were wrestlers, but we look like we're two kids dressed up for Halloween. You know, it's insane.
But that was the uniform, man. It's funny to this day. The one guy, and I'm gonna not tell you the name, and you're gonna guess it. The one guy that still wears a fanny pack every day to TV at work in WWE.
Michael Hayes.
Exactly, yeah. Michael Hayes.
Oh, we know
man.
That. Yeah.
So I mean, and I remember too, like even before I came to WWE, I don't know why, but I remember hearing about Omega, maybe reading about it, Dirt Sheets or something. And you guys, like, you know, the funny thing about, like, people from the UK, they always start wrestling when they're 13 or 14, like Regal and Dave Taylor and, you know, even Paige, they started so young. But you guys were the same. You started wrestling at 13, 14, 15, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And with your own company.
Especially, like, I mean, it was a real weird... You know, the segue from us was very interesting, but also very true in many ways, because we started wrestling in our backyard on a trampoline against one another, and we emulated what we saw. And we happened to run into this guy who was a true carny, not a wrestling carny, but a true carny who did shows at carnivals and fairs and whatnot. And he had a ring that was 20 by 20, and in the middle it had a trampoline that was 20 by 10. And he said, hey, I hear you guys wrestling in your backyard. He approached us. He said, would you guys like to come do this circuit with me, do carnivals, and, you know, we'll do
some shows.
So he
had a wrestling ring with a trampoline in the middle?
Yeah. And
wow.
It was 20, you know, it was the length of the ring. And then on the other sides it was 10 or 12.
Okay,
and then
gotcha.
It was like four or five feet on each side, and it was like concrete.
Hmm.
But, you know, like us, the challenge was like, oh, we want to go to the hard part and take, you know, we want people to believe our stuff's legit. We'll go up to the hard part and take bumps. And we got with this guy and did a few shows, and I remember the gig when he first started. That ended up becoming our promotion because we kind of went in business with him in the beginning, and he got $600. We would take like seven or eight guys. We'd have a lot of masks. We'd have a show in a box, you know, where a guy would wrestle without a mask, and he'd wrestle with a mask on.
Yes, yeah, so you could get extra match out of him.
Myself, Jeff, Shannon Moore, Marty Garner, Jason Arndt, who was later Joey Abs. We would go have this show, and we work for this guy, and this guy's like, well, I'm not making any money doing this deal. You know, it's not really going to work for me. We're like, are you kidding, man? We're going to be the next WWE. No. You know, but we knew, like, we have something here. We bought the ring from him, and we knew we had to get rid of the trampoline, and we completely redid the ring. And then in 93 is when we ran our first Omega show.
How old are you?
17 or 18 at that point. And, you know, Jeff was
15
or
whatever.
Matt hadn't got his degree in engineering yet, so that ring was brutal.
It was terrible.
The way we put it together, oh my God.
When the first show that we had with our hard ring after we redid it, when we took it down, it took us 8 hours to take the ring down.
Wow.
Because we did it like, because the pieces of plywood, each one was done with like a screw, you know, and when like they just sat and went down, it was like each one screwed in, like it was this huge puzzle, you know.
Right.
Like if you go to IKEA and buy a piece of furniture, and if you've ever had a tricky time with it, just imagine something that was 100 times bigger and 100 times more complicated. That's how the first ever wrestling ring was. It was like a wrestling ring from IKEA that you had to put together and take apart each time. But, you know, we did that show, and I just think our thing was looking back at this, and I said this a lot in my Ring of Honor promos. I had a real fun run there I was doing as a heel. And you know, I said I created the Ring of Honor wrestling style, because literally we had a bunch of guys who were athletes and could do a lot of really cool stuff, and we would go out and do a ton of high spots and a ton of cool moves and flips, but we had no idea what we were doing from a psychology standpoint. You know, and I think just the buzz of doing that, seeing 5, 6, 7, 8 guys doing that at one time in a show, people were like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. You know how these internet folks are. If word of mouth travels that guys are doing all these
amazing stuff. Well, that was pre-internet, though. 93, man. There was
It was, but it started coming into being around 94, 95, 96. You know, and we continued to get a little better, and we still didn't have a clue what we were doing until we went to WWE. You know, we were still just jumping around like, you know, crazed monkeys. You know, but it was one of those things, like, people were like, oh my God, this stuff is so neat. And then once we had an idea of where we're going, I think we were able to put together some pretty cool stuff.
Well, and who were these guys that, like, you guys all grew up together? You mentioned Marty Garner. I mean, there was like the crew of guys that came from this area that you guys kind of grew up through the system with and worked with for years, even got them into the WWE, or some of them were in the WWE.
Myself and Jeff, we grew up 2.5 miles from Shannon Moore, so he was right down the road. Mm-hmm. Marty Garner lived about 10 minutes from us. Jason Arndt lived about 10 minutes from us, the guy who was Joey Abs later.
Hurricane
and his partner Mike Howe, who's one of the Dups, they were about an hour from us. And we met them after we got into the business, going a little bit, like starting to wrestle on a more regular basis. Caprice Coleman, a guy who's in Ring of Honor right now, he grew up 10 minutes from us.
No kidding.
I mean, you know, Steve Corino had just moved down here. He lived in Rayford, which was about 20 minutes from us. I mean, we had a collection of guys, like, all within an hour.
It's a pretty talented group of guys.
An hour circle. And 13 guys wanted to sign contracts. Wow. They worked with us, which is pretty impressive.
And Marty Garner ended up being Rocky's assistant, the Rock's assistant.
Yeah, well, you know, Marty had a good run. You know, he didn't quite break the glass ceiling there. But
so, how was it for you as a promoter? I mean, you kind of started in the business as a promoter in a lot of ways.
I did. And, well, I did things, as you said before, like I raked pine straw. I sold pine straw, which literally I would spend all day and load up a truck that had framing on it with pine straw and it'd sell for like $100. You know, it would take 6-7 hours to do. But for me, that was a lot of money at the time. I worked at a car wash, and then I taught myself how to sew because we couldn't afford gear. It was so expensive at the time. So my mom had an old sewing machine. I dusted it off and taught myself how to do that. Jeff was landscaping. He had a full-time job. He had a guy that would let him off whenever so we could go and travel.
Right.
But my other source of income was being the promoter. And this is really funny. Like, I would go to Rose's, that franchise doesn't even exist anymore.
Is it a restaurant?
They're right here and there. No, it was like a Kmart or a Walmart. Rose's in this area. I would go there and I bought me a nice pair of pants and a nice shirt. And I had a little cheap-ass briefcase and I had some papers in it. And I would walk around, you know, like a little 17, 18-year-old Matt Hardy. I would walk into business and say, hi, how are you? I'm representing Omega Wrestling. My name is Matt Hardy. And I'd just like to see if you'd be interested in doing a sponsorship. We're, you know, the hottest promotions coming up in this Mid-Atlantic
area. You're hustling, man. Yeah.
Yeah, you know, and I would do that. I would do that, like, for a week straight, you know, and I would go get, you know, $500-$600 worth of sponsorships, enough to pay for the building and the show and make sure all the guys, like, my goal was like to have everyone like $20-$25.
Yeah.
If we made a little more at the door, then you get a little extra, brother, I'd bonus you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so looking back, it was like, God, it was embarrassing looking back at what I did. But at the same time, you know, I give it to myself because I had a little hustle in me and I was driven to do something more than what I was.
Well, and that's how you guys were able to make it.
The sewing he did was just incredible. I mean, you watched all those old Omega shows. The majority of the roster, I mean, Matt made the costumes. It was just incredible how fast he picked that up and learned it. Because, I mean, I gave it a try, and I just was
not your
was
horrible. Thing.
Yeah, not my thing at all. But, yeah, I would do some designing, but that was it. But then he would sew anything I designed right into that spandex.
Now, did you ever – I mean, obviously in this area, there's a lot of independent wrestlers in North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee. As a promoter, especially being a young promoter, were there a lot of kind of the old-timer sharks that were coming to try and take advantage of you, thinking this kid's a money mark and I'll just, you know, I'll get some easy money from him?
That's funny. I don't think anybody would have thought I was a money mark because it was very obvious I didn't have any I didn't have any money at that point, right. You know. But
they
it was
could
funny.
Take advantage of you.
Are you setting me up? Do you know this story?
I think you told it to
okay,
me, but
okay,
it's a
cool,
good one.
Great.
So.
Yeah. So Manny Fernandez, who was in this area, He was notorious. He had a huge reputation for like crashing shows and forcing his way on and making a payment. And this is right after we first met the Hurricane Shane Helms and his partner Mike Howe. And we were here in Sanford, ironically enough. It was here in Sanford at the National Guard Armory, right? You know, not far. It's actually right across town here. And it was a big show for us. It was the first one Shane and Mike were doing. And they had a shot on Friday the day before. And they'd ran into Manny at a strip club / restaurant the night before. And they're like, you know, Manny's like, hey, guys, how are you tonight? You know, I enjoyed seeing you at the show tonight. I think you guys got a lot of potential. You're doing great things in this business. Where are you guys at tomorrow? And they said, oh, we're in Sanford. And he said, you're in Stanford? And he said, no. And it kind of the light bulb went off. They knew that he was up to something. He said, no, we're in Sanford. He said, yeah, I'm in Sanford too. And he said, I don't think you would be there. This is our friend. It's just kind of young, new guys, whatever. He said, no, I'm booked there. So they show up and they said, hey, we just want to give you the heads up. We think Manny's going to show up today at the show and try and force his way on the show, so you're ready. So Manny shows up that day and he has Frankie Murdoch with him, who was the guy who was traveling with him like his stooge. And I think his deals, he was Murdoch's nephew or something like that. So he shows up at the show and he walks in with his bags, with his gimmicks, with his gear, everything, and rolls up and says, yeah, where do I get dressed at? And I was like, God. And I was like, you know, this is a guy that I watched growing up. Like,
yeah,
not just like Bull. As a teenager, but as a, like a child, like mm-hmm. 6 years old, 7 years old, whatever. And so I'm on there. And then I've heard recently, like, oh, you know, he brings guns to shows and he fights all the time. And, you know, I'm very innocent at this point. And I walk up to Manny and I go, hello, Manny. How are you, Mr. Fernandez? I'm the guy who's booking the show and I'm the promoter. He says, where do I get dressed? I said, well, I'm sorry. We can't use you on the show. He says, oh, no, I'm booked. He said, I got booked here. I said, well, if I didn't book you, then you didn't get booked. Yeah. He said, no, Henry Dean booked me. And it was some other guy that ran shows. He just threw a name out there. Yeah. I said, I'm sorry, Mr. Fernandez. You're not booked on the show. I said, there's no more money to pay anyone. Like, I have enough money to pay everyone, and that's it. So I'm sorry, I can't use you. I don't have any money to pay. He said, oh, no, I'm going to be on the show. He said, and I'm going to get paid, or somebody's going to get their ass kicked. And then he stepped up, got nose-to-nose, and he said, and it might be you. And then I just sat there like frozen. I was like,
you're like 18 years old.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah. Little baby Matt. And I go, well, I'm sorry you feel that way, Mr. Fernandez. Like with the utmost respect, I'm sorry you feel that way, Mr. Fernandez. But there's no money left to go around the show, and it's not going to happen. And when Mike and Shane originally, they were standing like kind of behind him, like the formation, they'd already slid around and got behind me, and it was like Shannon and Champagne and Jeff, and then we had like 9 guys on this side. And I said, well, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way, Mr. Fernandez, but no money's going to happen, and I can't use you on the show. And then talked him down a little bit, and then once he said, okay, well, that's fine. If I can't wrestle on the show, can I at least set up my gimmick table and sell my gimmicks? And I said, okay, that's fine. We can let you do that. And he was okay with it. And we saw him years later after we were with WWE. We flew in from somewhere into Charlotte. We were going to go home that night, but we were checking in during the day before we went to the show that night. And he was a janitor at a La Quinta in Charlotte. He said, hey, kid Hardy. He said, remember when you and your brother stood up to me when I tried to force my way on that show? He said, I'm so proud of you. You guys stood up to me and shut me down. Only in wrestling, you know. Yeah. Now that's something like, I'm so proud of you.
Now he's your friend,
know?
Right?
You know, yeah. Like if I hadn't made it, he would have hated me and wanted to kill me because he didn't get that other $75 payoff. Jesus Christ.
I just love the fact he tried to bully you to get on the show. But see, you were learning the ways of the wrestling business, man. Like, you know, it's funny coming up. Like, I remember thinking, if I could just get onto Stampede Wrestling. Like, those guys probably make $150,000 a year, like $200.
They're rich.
If I could just get there.
Right.
And then you find out they made, like, you know, $50 yeah. every second week if Stu paid them. But you didn't know, right? You just see some on TV and think this is, like, these guys are huge, right? Mm-hmm,
for yeah. sure. You know, it even goes on to now. Like, I stay so busy, you know, and, I mean, Jeff just has TNA right now. But, you know, I'm going to be doing some TNA with him coming up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've been doing Ring of Honor. And I've been doing all the best shots I can do around. So I've stayed so busy. And Shane is kind of, I've given over the reins to him, and he kind of brought back Omega, and he's been doing it. He's been handling the booking and everything else right now. And it's funny, people contact us nonstop, like, hey, can we get a job with Omega? Can we do that? Like, guys, you know, this is just a show that we do every few months. It's not like you're going to make a living doing this. They think, just like you said, there's like that, there's that wild dream or belief that, like, oh my God, Omega's back. That, you know, this is the, like, you know, ECW was in the day or something. You know, when we're not on TV, we're not doing things regularly. We do shows that are really good when we do them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like a regular gig where you're going to make a living, right, and you've made it now, you know?
Yeah. We're talking to Matt and Jeff Hardy, the Hardy Boys, Team Extreme. They're both wrestling solo and together for TNA Impact. And coming up, we'll talk about their mentor, Michael P.S. Hayes, and the ladder match that cemented their legacies in WWE forever. TrueCar.com is changing car buying forever. Yes, every day TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Some features not available in all states. In the first 6 months of this year, over 275,000 cars were sold by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. TrueCar users save an average of $3,221 off MSRP. When you're ready to buy a car, just follow these three easy steps. First, go to TrueCar.com and find out what other people paid for the car you're looking at. Then, register at TrueCar.com to see upfront pricing information and lock in your savings. Third step is simple. Just print out your TrueCar savings certificate and take it to the TrueCar certified dealer for a better, hassle-free car buying experience. Remember, every day, TrueCar users receive negotiation-free, guaranteed savings. Save time, save money, and never overpay. Visit TrueCar.com today. That's TrueCar.com.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay, judges.
That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
You're listening to Talk is Jericho.
We're back with Matt and Jeff Hardy. In those early days when you guys were running your own Omega promotion, were you Jeff Hardy at the time, or did you have another character that you were doing back in these days?
I was Jeff Hardy, a.k.a. Wolverine, and then I was Will-O-The-Wisp, so I had a good guy and bad guy persona.
And Willow was the with the mask.
Yeah, with the mask.
Now, I actually did some research, and I found some other names. I'll ask you guys what the gimmicks were for these.
This would be good.
Yeah, see if I can find them. These, of course, was on YouTube, on Wikipedia. So, okay, so Jeff, you were Jeff Hardy. You were the Galaxian.
Oh yeah.
Was that in Omega?
That was in Omega. No, it wasn't. It was never in Omega.
Yeah, that was in the backyard. In
the backyard.
Okay,
trampoline wrestling federation.
That was the boing.
Yeah, that guy, the Galaxian, he was from outer space. Yeah.
Oh, was he? All right. That's sure a planet.
Not parts unknown, outer space.
He was and from a Planemo that doesn't have a sun.
And then we had the Gladiator.
Gladiator was cool.
Okay.
Gladiator was, I think he had a partner named the Executioner.
Yeah, he did, yeah.
Was my brother, and we both wore the ski mask.
Yeah, the Walmart ski mask, Family Dollar ski mask.
Spider-Man Zubaz.
Top-notch gear.
When I had my own wrestling company called the BTWF, Big Time Wrestling Federation, it was just me and my friend wrestling on high school gym mats. We actually had a tag team called the Balaclavas that wore balaclavas because all we had were ski masks, right, which are also called balaclavas. So just be honest about it.
Yeah,
we're
right,
called
yeah,
the balaclavas because we wear them.
I like it.
The Iceman.
Iceman from Iceland.
Yeah. Obviously.
Naturally, yeah. Obviously. Had it spoke with a bad, inconsistent accent.
Icelandic accent, yeah.
Now, this is a good one. Keith Davis.
Keith Davis.
Wow. Is that a name?
He was a trip from Charlotte, right?
Oh, that's funny that's there. Keith Davis is the guy. He was supposed to wrestle Scott Hall. The first time we ever went to TV.
Yeah. Oh.
And they pulled, this guy said, you know, like he was one of Stallion's guys, and Stallion's guys got mad. They were paying him to be trained, $3,000, and we weren't. But WWE mm-hmm. liked us because we were like young, athletic-looking kids, and we'd try and take crazy bumps for the guys. So this guy, Keith Davis, wrestling Razor Ramon, Scott Hall at the time, and like 15-20 minutes before the match, board, I said, I can't do it. I can't take his finish. It's going to hurt me. I can't do it. I can't do it. I'm so sorry, Stallion. So then they pulled him out, and Tony Greer's like, who can we do it? And Sting's like, oh, brother, get the fruit here, the young fruit. He said, get the young fruit here. He can take all the bumps. Yeah. He can take that move real easy. And, you know, Jeff is 16. He had to lie about his age.
Wow.
He had to back it up 2 years to sign the release form at WWE so that he could actually wrestle. And I see just pale-ass little Jeff. My brother goes up, Scott, oh, hi, I'm Jeff. Nice to meet you,
well,
sir.
I was terrified, man.
And you know, he said, well, this other guy couldn't take my finish. And I don't know what the hell he's doing here if he can't take a bump. You know, kid, I'll beat you with this back suplex off the top and the finish. Everything else, just listen to me. So Jeff's going on a Raw, and I went on a live Raw the first time I was there, and it was in 94 when we first went, and it was against Nikolai Volkov, and he could barely speak English at that point, so I knew it was going to be disastrous.
Barely walk,
barely speak English.
It seems
barely
like
wrestle.
I went out on the taped one before
you did.
Which I was the first one of us all to go out and talk about.
Where was this show at?
Youngstown, Ohio.
Youngstown, and Ohio. How did you guys get booked on the show?
Italian Stallion.
Okay.
He drove us up there, like a big church van. We met him in Charlotte and took a whole crew up there.
Well, that's what happened, too. When we first started doing our shows with the guy that I was telling you was doing the carnival shows, who had the half real ring, half trampoline, half concrete ring, half trampoline ring, one of the guys who wrestled for us met a guy named Eddie Rainwater, who was drove a Coke truck, and he was actually a trained independent professional wrestler who worked for Stallion. And he came out to one of our shows, and he came out to one of our practice sessions, and he said, oh, you guys are great. I want to introduce you to Stallion. And we went to Stallion, and I worked for him the first time because he needed a guy to go to WWE, and then a couple of his guys had canceled or couldn't get off work for 3 days. So he said, hey, do you have any other guys? So him and Champagne and a couple other guys went and had a tryout. And then Stallion took these guys, and we all went, 14 of us, crammed up in a church van. You know, we drove 15 hours and, you know, did the 3 days, and it was $150 a day for an extra at that point. And as soon as we got in the van and drove, like, you know, 7-8 miles away, Stallion stopped and said, all right, brother, he said, if you guys want to go to the next town, I'm going to need a $100 booking fee from each one of the 150.
Wow.
You know, we stayed, like, 8 in a room. You know, and he was really racking up the money. Once again, it was the business, you know,
yeah,
about like
it
being selfish, taking advantage.
As he came in.
You know, if you give someone a break, then you take as much of theirs as
right,
you can
right.
take.
Right, of course. So Keith Davis was the guy that was supposed to work with Scott. Now, were you announced as Keith Davis?
No, they announced me as Jeff Hardy.
Okay, they did, but there were people who made that mistake later. Like, I think it was reported, like, you know, it beats Keith Davis because that was on the original run sheet. Yeah. But Jeff went out there, and Scott Hall beat the shit out of him. And it was strange because he hurt his knee, did the thing that, like, Rick Steiner would do where he puts him upside down and runs him with the turnbuckle and his knee at the pole. And the Click guys were always nice to us after that because they felt bad they hurt Jeff. And, you know, you hear terrible things about him, and I know that there's a lot of bad stuff that's went on with him, whatever, but they were always cool to us after that.
Were you scared to death at 16 years old, man?
Oh, yeah, I was terrified. I went out there just completely terrified. But then once we got going, man, I'll never forget feeling that ring was, oh my God, it was so hard. And I was like, oh my God, it's like a kickboxer. There's no give to it whatsoever. And then I just took it, man, and did the best I could. But yeah, I was terrified.
And how much did you weigh at the time?
About 185, 190, maybe.
So pretty skinny, though.
Yeah, I was real skinny. Yeah, skinny and scared as a rail.
And then you worked with Nikolai Volkov.
Mm-hmm.
Probably did not have as exciting of a match as Jeff did, just by the fact it was Nikolai.
Yeah, I mean, he really just beat Jeff up the whole while, you know, so it wasn't super exciting. Nikolai tried to put a little couple dips in there, you know, and like, I remember I got to dive off the top turnbuckle and miss a crossbody at one point, but it was okay. I remember a funny story was, Tony Gurria had came up and said, you know, whatever you do, kid, this is live. You can't mess up. If you mess up, they'll never bring you back again. I was like, okay. And I'm sweating. And Nikolai comes up and says, oh, don't worry. He said, it'd be very easy. He said, and I'm not hard anyway. Every time I go out, I mess up stuff. So don't worry about it. I'm like, oh, my God, this is going to be it for me. You know, and it was funny because I wanted to know, like, everything we were going to do at that point. You know, I was very nervous about going out there or not, but we didn't. You know?
Tell me the whole match. So then did you guys get a regular gig as extras after that, or how did that come up?
We did. What ended up happening is we would go with Stallion probably every 4, 5, 6 months, and then eventually Stallion's guys got upset, and they said they're going to stop paying him to be trained, because all we did was like his, you know, live event shows, in theory. We would drive all of them down the East Coast and do shows for free, but then we'd still get to go to WWE, and WWE they wanted, you know, the Hardys and their guys. So then Stallion left us one time. So we drove on our own to a trip in Georgia. We met Chief J Strongbow, and we said, hey, don't call Stallion, just call us. And then myself, Jeff, Jason Arn, and Marty Garnar started getting booked individually, and that's kind of how we got our break. And then,
yeah, that was the moment.
You know, and then from there, after they were calling us, then we ended up getting to do, like, more, you know, better matches or some dark matches, and they looked at us. And
we actually got flew to a few TVs.
We got flew to a few TVs, and it just, as time went on, it segued from being, we segued from being jobbers without a contract to being jobbers with a contract, you know, in 97, 98.
And who were you talking to at the time? Who was your connection in the WWE that would...
Chief J?
Chief J Strongbow, yeah.
Cool. Was Howard calling you? Do you remember Howard used to call?
Yeah,
Howard Wood, yeah.
How
Howard
cool was that the first time I got a message on my answer machine from Howard? This is Howard Finkel from the WWE. And it's
It was very cool. I remember, you know, this is, you know, like you said, how cool it is for Howard to call you. Like, we were in the Southern Pines Armory getting ready to do a show, and Howard had called us and told us that we're flying us up to these TVs if we were free to do it. We're like, of course we're free.
You free? Let me check my schedule.
Right.
I remember watching you guys. I was in Calgary. It was on one of the shows. I can't remember what it was, like Superstars or whatever. And you were wrestling Phil LaFon and Doug Furness. You went to do like Spring a top rope acai moonsault, from the second, and just slipped and just completely bailed. But I remember thinking, man, that's pretty crazy that you even tried that. I'd never really seen that before.
Yeah, and I would nail it at our shows, you know, because we had cables for ropes.
Yeah.
And I went for it, and oh, my God, and, you know, things like that happen.
Sure.
But I was so amped. I was like, somebody's going to remember me. This is going to be so beautiful. But, man, it was just heartbreaking. Crash and burn. Oh, you okay?
And the best thing was it was a taped show, but they didn't even edit it. They just left it in.
Yeah,
whatever.
Which I would have been mad if they wouldn't have let me in.
Yeah. Right. And, you know, a little known fact about that match is we had it set originally. He was doing that. I was coming in. I was going to take the heat, and Jeff was doing the comeback. We had to change that on the fly completely.
And just took the heat.
Yeah, I was like, what? I think they got to get steam on Jeff now. That's happening. I think it's going to be hard to avoid this.
But I remember your tights, too. They had, like, sunflowers on them and all these, like, fringe, and they were really kind of cool.
Hope, faith.
And that's right. Because you made them, right?
We'd go pick up that wild material, and Matt would sew it together. Man, it was crazy.
They were pretty inspiring. I mean, they were so inspiring and inspired the Young Bucks whole persona, you know.
That's right. Have you guys ever wrestled with those guys?
On August 2nd for the first
time. That's kind of like a pretty cool match. You know?
Yeah, no, people are... we wrestled the Briscoes, which was really, really fun. Those guys are awesome. And we did great. We drew 1,600 people in Cameron.
Wow.
Great house. We sold out, like, the high school we went to.
Was that an Omega show?
That was an Omega show.
There
you
go.
So, yeah, Omega's doing big business, brother. But we're not going to be able to make you a living.
Manny Fernandez is going to show up next time.
He is. He's going to be here anytime. I know. He's already tried to get booked.
He might even be the janitor at this hotel. He might try and come on this podcast.
His money. I am booked for this podcast.
Jericho called me. His agent, Ralph, has called me. I am on this podcast.
So you guys finally were jobbers with the contract. And I remember I came to the WWE in August of 99, and you guys were just starting to get a run, a push. What finally, I mean, it's a pretty rare thing for guys that were jobbers, quote-unquote jobbers, extras, enhancement guys, to end up getting a push. What was it that finally helped you guys, you know, break free from, you know, being just guys that were losing to getting legitimate shove?
I think even like you said that, you know, the match with Furnace and LaFon, we had a dark match with the Truth Commission. We had a lot of matches where like, well, there's potential here. There's potential. Mm-hmm. Let's see if we can do something. Eventually they signed us, and then after they signed us, it was we came in and then we beat Kai and Tai in our debut, our official debut after we'd signed a contract. And then we beat Too Cool the night after. Then we did about 50 jobs. And then we beat the Road Wars, the fake Road Wars that were there at the end when they kind of tweaked them up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and then we did some more jobs. But we started having matches with Edge and Christian. We were going back and forth on house shows, like winning and losing. And then we had some great matches on TV. And I think just that series of matches against those guys are like, wow, these teams are really good. If we built these Hardys, they could have great matches on a competitive level. And I almost think it was like it helped us, and at the same time too, like Adam originally was going to be a singles guy, but I think that almost they said, well, him and Christian together are so good as a tag team, let's run with this for a while. So then they put us with Michael Hayes. We started feuding with those guys initially. We had a run with the tag titles, which it was one of those things like where you know you're the tag team champions, but you're not the best tag team in the world or the deserving champions. And it's where like the titles are helping you more than they're helping. You're helping them, you know, is that scenario. But we really turned the corner when we had that first ever tag team ladder match. You know,
sure.
That was the thing that made us. And from there, just kind of, you know, went crazy after that.
What was the idea in putting you with Michael Hayes? Because he wasn't like a TV character at the time. He was an announcer maybe or something?
I know they wanted to find a way to change us, to refresh us. And we didn't know Michael well then. I mean, Michael helped us out during that period more than anyone else ever did.
He took a real liking to you guys.
We learned a lot about him. And you know, like I'd referred to him in the past as our wrestling daddy, and he is. I mean, he's responsible for a lot of our success. We can't deny that. Because I know he taught me a new way to think, especially from a psychology standpoint. But I think Michael was trying to look for a way to get in and kind of have one more run. And maybe the door opened up. They said, hey, we want to put someone with the Hardys. We think, you know, the three of you guys might do something. He's like, yeah, I'll take it. Because I remember he told me before it happened, like 3 or 4 weeks before we're going to do this, I want you to be thinking about it. You know, start get your wheels turning. And it's funny. It really introduced me to a whole new way of thinking about things. Mm-hmm. Because before I was with Michael, and I don't know if you feel like this as well, Jeff, but I almost thought about like if you were booked to do something good, it was like, okay, cool, this is good. Sometimes you're booked and you're a master of this as well now, you know, and it takes a while. It comes with experience. Like sometimes you can be booked to do something that's not meant to be good for you. It's not meant for you. You're not spotlighted. You're not highlighted, but you can still go out and make it great for you because you know how to do things the right way.
That's right. Yeah.
You know, so Michael really introduced me to that mindset and that train of thought.
How about you, Jeff? Did you start realizing that there was a whole new psychology in the WWE that you didn't know it was more than just moves?
For sure. I totally agree with what Matt just said. But like one defining moment for me going way back to the jobbing days was when I wrestled King Kong Bunny and I did the vertical backflip on a clothesline.
Good call.
And just Scott Hall. And I mean, he would always talk about that Kenton Nash, and they would always put me over. Just he's the one that did the flip, you know, and they always. And I think that moment right there, every time I went out there, I said, I'm going to do something that, you know, they can't resist me. They're going to have to love me. Well, you know, and I'm going to lose, but I'm going to lose well.
Right.
And impress somebody. But, yeah, and then getting with Michael, we just learned more and more about how to structure things. And the art form just became so much better.
Yeah, it's amazing. People always talk about, like, the WWE style. And it's a real thing. You know, I mean, when I first came in, I did not know the WWE style. I didn't know what I was doing. 9 years in the business, and I didn't know anything about this whole style. and you realize, like, wow, what was I doing? Like, I didn't know anything.
Right.
You know, all of us, because it was about the moves, and I can do this. I'll do a double moonsault. And all it's like, who gives a shit?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that thing, man.
Yeah. Yeah. You think you know it all, but then it's so eye opening. You know? Yeah. Like, once you get an idea, like, oh my God, wow. I can't believe I missed this.
That's right.
You know, and you just feel it makes you realize, like, oh my God, like, I was just one of the people that's sitting in the seats because I don't really get the whole concept behind this work.
That's right. Yeah. I'm a good athlete.
Yeah.
It really doesn't matter.
Right.
Talking about breaking through, you mentioned the I think it was the Terry Invitational, the best of seven series.
It was going to be that originally, but it ended up being the best of five.
Okay,
you know, it's TV, everything's condensed. Yeah, they shortened it on us.
But I remember that ladder match, man, because I came in, I did a couple things, and I was just kind of sitting around not doing much, and I was watching that pay per view backstage and seeing this match of you and Edge and Christian and Jeff and Matt breaking through to the next level. Because that was kind of the first modern-day ladder match.
Yeah.
You know, because we had them, you know, in the 90s with Shawn and Razor and Bret and Shawn, etc. But they kind of went away for a while a little bit, and then you guys came out there and just basically redefined the norm of what a ladder match was.
Yeah, I mean, their ladder match was great. Theirs was like the Luthes ladder match.
Yeah.
Ours was the Hardy Boys ladder match.
Yeah.
You know, kind of we kind of upped the ante. We raised it up a level.
Well, tell us about that. How did you guys sit down and work on that for a while, or how did that come together as far as putting together the match?
Going back and talking about Michael, like, I just want to mention this. It was very awkward at the time, but when we had to be made over, we went to a mall and
this
was huge for us.
They wanted to get out of the Matt Hardy costumes and into
It was going to be hair in the face, you know, something different. Just go out to the mall and find something. And Michael was picking up these, you know, pre-bird street fight ideas or whatever. But
so Hayes was going to be your fashion consultant.
No. At first, we had to change our outfits. Michael was like, "I don't know, guys. Maybe we just should get some jeans and a big belt buckle." And we're going, "Brother, I think we can get some jeans. Let's update it a little bit to the 90s, you know, late 90s.
Yeah. It's somewhere in that Gadzooks or Hot Topic, you know, stores like that is where we kind of went. And we were looking for how were we going to be, what were we going to look like. We found the kickwear pants and the tight shirts, and I felt so weird going out there the first time. I'll never forget how awkward it was. Like, look at us, man. We got shirts on.
It was like a dream. Like, you know, oh my God, we went to the ring in our clothes, not our tights. Yeah. You know, that's what it felt like at first.
Well, you know, you have to continue, you know, like different colors for different shows or whatever, but oh my God, it was the greatest thing we ever did.
Well, it's funny too, because now that's the Hardy Boys look. Oh, but I remember even with the lighted jacket thing, I was like, I wonder if that would, like, am I going to feel stupid? Is this going to be dumb?
All right.
And now it's like, if I don't show up with the stupid jacket, it's like, where's your jacket? Right. Same thing with you guys, you know? Sure, it's like, that's the look. But I'm sure at first you felt like you're wearing scuba diving gear out there or whatever.
It's getting hard, man, to do things that hasn't been done.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you pioneer or revolutionize something, you're always rolling the dice because it might, you know, it might be a big failure. You know, it might flop. And if it does, then you always remember, remember this when these guys wore these kickwear clothes or when Jericho wore the light bright jacket. Yeah. You know what? You never know. But, like, you know, if you go out and you try and do it the right way, and presentations, everything. I mean, if you can get something over, then you will always be remembered.
Well,
and
people started wearing your clothes, like fans. I mean, it was like Hardy Boys and then Team Extreme. It was such a cool, like you said, had never been seen before.
Yeah.
And it was like a real punk rock emo thing before there was emo even.
And it was the worst thing that happened to indie wrestling, because then, like, everybody said, "Oh my God, we don't even have to go get tights
right
now.
Right.
We can just go to Hot Topic and buy the Hardy Boys gear. You know, and we can be Extreme. You know, we don't even have to wrestle. We just jump off ladders."
But it's funny too. Even when I saw you guys when you came to the door, I forgot how big you guys are. Like, tall, like, obviously both in great shape, but not everybody in the indies that were wearing those costumes afterwards were like that, you know?
Right. Hey, man, I got to go back real quick. I remember we went in and tried on our stuff. We were in Hot Topic. We wore the outfits. We come out, you know, Jeff and I, we had our belt on, but our pants hung a little lower, loose. And then I remember, like, we got dressed, and we're like, "I don't know, man, it looks pretty cool. We'll see if we can pull it off in the ring as far as wrestling in it." And then I remember the dressing room door open, and Michael walked up, and his pants were real high. And he's like, "All right, guys, I think it looks good. We're ready to go." And I remember Jeff and I just kind of looked at each other like, "Boy, this is going to be an interesting experiment."
Yeah. He's like your crazy old uncle or
something.
Yeah,
he was,
like that,
yeah. Yeah, Michael Hardy there was ready.
We ended up kind of getting a sponsorship from the T. Riley people, because they gave us a bunch of free shirts, you know.
Oh, okay.
They were the company that made those shirts. And,
yeah.
But going back to the ladder match now with Edge and Christian in the tights and then us and Art, it made that war so much better. Mm-hmm. You know, the different uniforms for that.
But when you guys were putting that match together, did you sit down and say, like, okay, we got to do something that's never been seen before? Or was it just a natural thing? I mean, because it was really amazingly put together with so many spots we'd never seen before.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Thank you, too. But I was going to say, I mean, Jeff and I did those very regularly, like in Omega. You know, like we would, when I was Matt Hardy, just without a mask or anything, my own identity, I was High Voltage and then later Surge after the team in WCW stole my name from a demo tape that came in from the WCW Amateur
High Voltage.
Challenge. Yeah.
Our attitude will determine our altitude.
How'd that work out for them? And Jeff and I had ladder matches a lot, and we suggested it initially, and we didn't think they would ever go for it.
So it was your idea?
Yeah, the ladder match was our idea with Adam and Jay, and they were cool with doing it, and we thought, man, we can nail this thing. Like, we can do something really different and update it and do some things that have never been done, because we'd done tons of crazy stuff in the past that we thought we could, you know, they would be able to translate over onto WWE television. And we had this match. I remember they wanted us to fly up to Stanford. They were so worried and concerned about it because they knew how we wrestled. They wanted us to come up to Stanford and go over the match. And was it Christian that got stuck that time? Remember?
Seems like it was.
I think it was just myself, Jeff, and Adam. I want to say Jay got stuck, like, because of weather or whatever. And we went there and we started putting the frame of this match together. And Michael Hayes was there. And we started working it out piece by piece. But then we sat down, I remember, in the Gund Arena in that hall in the back, and we all sat just, you know, with our legs spread out, with our back against the wall in a certain little hallway, and we put everything together step by step. And you know, we went out there, man. It was like magic. And the next night we went out and got a standing ovation for that, and it just felt special. Like,
you knew this was your chance. If you hit a home run,
yeah,
you're on your way. If you didn't, you might not get another shot.
We knew we were going to get an opportunity that could make us or break us, you know, so we had to nail this one.
What were the reactions? Did you ever have any relationship with Vince at that point in time, other than hello, sir?
that was about it. You know, like, you know, once in a while, you know, you would kind of get to banter with him back and forth, but really it was more or less like, you know, hello or goodbye, whatever. Mm-hmm. I remember he congratulated us after the match and thought it was great. And I remember the next day he was just shaking his head like, God, how'd you guys do that? And you're still walking, whatever. Like, God, with that age, I remember being young and invincible. That was nice. You know, the recuperation time wasn't very long, but everyone else, it really, people took us serious. Not only did fans start appreciating, but like people within the office, they're like, they saw potential within us. You know, so that match was just, we turned such a huge corner that day.
Plus, you guys were getting over with that. Like you said, a standing ovation that wasn't, you weren't milking, you weren't looking for it. It just
no
happened.
Pandering.
Yeah, no pandering. It just happened. Okay, we'll stop right here with Matt and Jeff Hardy. What a great first part, but I got another part. We're going to pick it up again on Friday. We'll get into Team Extreme and Lita and the substance abuse problems that almost ended both of their careers and their lives. Plus, we'll talk a little TNA, since Matt and Jeff are both working for Impact now. So much more with my brothers, my friends, Matt and Jeff Hardy on Friday. Stick around for that. Thank you for listening. Thanks to Matt and Jeff Hardy for part one. Part two is on Friday. And thanks to all of you who picked up the new Fozzy album, Do You Want to Start a War? We debuted at number 54, our highest chart debut ever on the Billboard charts. How fruit is that? Our tour with Theory of a Dead Man starts tonight, September 17th, in Tempe, Arizona at the Marquee. We're in Abilene on Thursday, San Antonio on Friday the 19th, and Shreveport on the 20th, plus Night of Champions on Sunday, my last WWE appearance for a while. Then back on the road with Fozzy. I'll still be out there, guys. I'm still doing my thing. Plus, my book, The Best in the World at What? I have no idea. The third book, the third in the trilogy of Jericho's life story, is coming out on October 13th. I'll be doing a lot of appearances and signings for that. You can pre-order that book on Amazon, which I want you to do by going to podcastone.com, clicking on the Keep Our Podcast Free banner at the top of the page, then click on Talk is Jericho. You'll see my Amazon links, UK, USA, and Canada A. I want you to pre-order The Best in the World at What? I have no idea. When you do that, Amazon will kick a little cash back to the show so I can keep doing this for you for free for twice a week. I'm helping you, you're helping me. It's a symbiotic function, very, very beneficial to both. There's no extra fees or hidden charges when you go on Amazon through my link. You're just getting your shopping done. You're helping me out on the process. So many cool things coming up with Chris Jericho, and I'm glad that you're here with me to join me for the ride. That's it. Another exciting edition of Talk is Jericho, entertaining edition of Talk is Jericho. In the meantime, and in between time, stay hard, stay hungry, peace, love, and hugs. We'll see you on Friday for the second half of this crazy, cool, killer conversation with Matt and Jeff Hardy, the Hardy, yeah, boys!
You can download new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday at podcastone.com. That's podcastone.com.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million. What color is the White House?
I know this. 5 seconds. Oh, switching to GEICO could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay. Judges? That's true, Kevin. They'll allow it. Congratulations. You're a winner.
Woo! GEICO. Because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Daddy, where do babies come from?
Honey?
Mommy went to the store.
Oh, well, you see, there's a mommy and a daddy, right?
Right.
And see, when they call GEICO, they could save a bunch of money on car insurance.
Oh, really? And that makes them happy?
Yes, that makes them very happy.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad we could have this talk, Sunshine.
GEICO, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
Syria Peace Talks? I'm Ben Thomas with an AP News Minute. Syrian rebels have rejected peace talks being proposed by Russia. They're accusing Moscow of failing to pressure its ally, President Bashar Assad, to end the conflict. Christmas may be over, but the shopping isn't. Hazel Ginn was at Macy's Herald Square in New York today.
It's not too bad. Even we went up to the 9th floor, and we managed to get in a queue of about 4 deep, so not bad. Yeah, and then we went to another one, and it was only a couple, so we kind of timed it well, I think.
America's research group, which focuses on consumer behavior, projects holiday sales up about 5% this year. Harley Davidson is placing a renewed emphasis on teaching people to ride as part of its efforts to attract more customers. The company is expanding the number of dealerships with the Harley Riding Academy. The move comes as the industry grapples with years of declining sales and an aging customer base. I'm Ben Thomas.